further harm to those we're trying to help.
That's Ethan Paul, research associate at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We'll link to his article, Biden Doesn't Understand the New Cold War. To see part one of our discussion, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for two full-time jobs, a director of finance administration and a human resources manager. Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe, wear a mask, save lives.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's coronavirus vaccine mandate kicks in today for city, county, and state employees. OHSU predicts Oregon will reach herd immunity from COVID-19 by December 26th, and the murder trial for the men who killed Ahmaud Arbery begins today in Georgia with jury selection. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 18th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. Today is the deadline for state employees in Oregon and Washington to be fully vaccinated against COVID-19 unless they have a religious or medical exemption. Vaccines remain one of the most effective ways to prevent deaths and hospitalizations caused by coronavirus. The vaccines are also effective at slowing transmission. State employees have until 11:59 p.m. Monday to become fully vaccinated against COVID-19. This means October 4th was the final day to receive a second dose of Pfizer or Moderna, or the single-dose Johnson & Johnson shot to be considered fully vaccinated in time. Both Multnomah County and the City of Portland require all employees, with the exception of some police officers and members of the Sheriff's Department, to be fully vaccinated by Monday. Multnomah County officials said that only about 20 out of 6,000 workers have not yet been vaccinated. Governor Kate Brown also signed two executive orders mandating vaccines for employees of executive branch agencies, as well as educators and healthcare workers. Employees of federal agencies and companies that work for the federal government must be fully vaccinated by December 8th. Altogether, about 3/5 of adults working in Oregon are covered under one or more of these mandates. The legality of Oregon's COVID-19 mandates is still being determined in the courts. There are several lawsuits underway, but two initial rulings this month were not favorable to plaintiffs wanting to block the mandates from taking effect. The court said that arguments being made by state police officers, healthcare workers, and others impacted by the mandate did not warrant immediate intervention because they had little to no chance of succeeding. These cases, as well as some other ones in states like New York and Maine, are setting up a much larger legal fight that could come before the Supreme Court. A new state forecast from Oregon Health and Science University says the deadly spike in COVID-19 infections that began over the summer should near its end around Christmas. However, at least 177,000 more infections are still expected in the state over the next 2 months. The Oregon Health Authority said that hospitalizations for COVID-19 continue to decline in the state, but some regions still have high rates of hospitalization and death. Patients with COVID-19 account for about 24% of all cases in the ICU statewide. At the peak of the spike, they took up more than 50% of ICU beds. The number of breakthrough cases, infections in people who've been vaccinated, has risen, accounting for about 27% of new infections last week. Federal and state health officials have moved to approve booster shots of vaccines for those already inoculated due to the rise in breakthrough cases. Vaccinated patients still account for less than 5% of hospitalizations and less than 1% of deaths. Oregon's immunity index shows that currently 22% of Oregonians remain vulnerable to the virus, having neither been vaccinated or exposed. The forecast also predicts that Oregon could reach herd immunity for the Delta variant around December 26th. OHSU says that is when 85% of the state population would either be vaccinated or already exposed to the virus. The OHSU report says the timeline could be slowed by the trend of Oregonians wearing masks less often or gathering indoors or outside in large groups. While a high number of deaths have been reported recently, deaths are the last indicator to rise or fall in a spike. The current numbers are projected to decrease as hospitalizations and infections have already gone down. The murder trial for the killing of 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery begins today in Georgia with jury selection. The three white men accused of chasing down and killing Arbery, a black man out for a jog, are set to stand trial for murder. Gregory McMichael, his son Travis McMichael, and their neighbor William Roddy Bryan Jr. are charged with malice and felony murder and have pled not guilty. They also face charges of aggravated assault, false imprisonment, and criminal attempt to commit false imprisonment. Arbery was fatally shot February 23rd of 2020 while out jogging in Brunswick, Georgia. The McMichaels say they were conducting a citizen's arrest on Arbery, who they suspected of burglary, and that Travis McMichael shot him in self-defense. Brian, who recorded video of the incident, allegedly hit Arbery with his truck after he joined the McMichaels in chasing Arbery. After the shooting, the three men were allowed to leave the scene and were not arrested until after the video of the incident was made public more than 2 months later. According to the Glynn County Court, where the trial will take place, 600 potential jurors have been summoned to appear in an off-site location on Monday. The jurors will be placed in panels of 20 once they make their way to the court. Another 400 potential jurors have been summoned to appear next Monday. By the end of the selection process, just 12 jurors and 4 alternates will be chosen to serve. The three men have also been indicted on federal hate crime and attempted kidnapping charges. They've pled not guilty to those charges as well. Arbery's father, Marcus Arbery Sr., says his family wants justice, adding, quote, "We want the right people to see that this was wrong. No matter how they try to tarnish my boy's name, he didn't do no wrong. He was out for his jog. They have to make this right so the world can go forward," end quote. Children in North Minneapolis marched over the weekend to end gun violence after 12-year-old London Bean became the third child shot and killed in the neighborhood this year. With more on the story, it's Faven Gerezgeher with the Racial Reckoning Project.
Saturday, over 80 people participated in a children's march to end gun violence in North Minneapolis. Organizers say the event was initiated by the family of 12-year-old London Bean, who was shot and killed in September. A suspect has been identified, but is still on the run from police. Bean was the third child killed in a shooting in the neighborhood this year.
None of these kids have gotten justice, not even one. And that right there is a message within itself.
That was Allegra Kennedy, Bean's aunt and a longtime activist in North Minneapolis. She attended the march with her children. Kennedy says everyone should be getting involved before gun violence impacts their own families.
Oh, now you don't get it.
Shut it down.
The teenagers don't get it.
Shut it down.
The
moms
don't get it.
Shut it down.
The event, a collaborative effort by several community organizations, included a celebration of children. Wisdom Young, with the nonprofit Black, Bold, and Brilliant, led a pledge affirming community values.
I pledge to honor and protect.
I pledge to honor and protect.
All Black life.
All Black life.
I pledge to protect and value.
I pledge to protect and value.
Our beautiful Black children.
Our beautiful Black children.
Our collective Black future.
Our collective Black future.
We will win together.
We will win together.
Ashe and Solidarity.
Young and other organizers urged those who attended to understand their collective responsibility to end gun violence. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Faven Garazgihar.
Racial Reckoning, the Arc of Justice, is produced and supported by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, in partnership with KMLJ Radio and the Minnesota Humanities Center.
On Monday, the Biden administration urged the Supreme Court to temporarily block the Texas law that bans most abortions in the state while legal challenges move forward. The U.S. Justice Department brief argues that the law, in effect, would let Texas disregard half a century of Supreme Court precedents that forbid states from banning abortions before fetal viability or about 22 to 24 weeks into pregnancy. The challenge Texas law, called Senate Bill 8, has been in force since the beginning of September and effectively bars abortion after about 6 weeks of pregnancy. The Texas law, which has no exceptions for pregnancies resulting from rape or incest, has an unusual feature that has complicated efforts to challenge it in court. Instead of making state officials responsible for enforcing the law, it allows private citizens to sue abortion providers and others who help people obtain the procedure. That can include financial assistance or giving someone a ride to a clinic. Justice Samuel Alito, who oversees the federal appeals court responsible for Texas, asked officials there to file their response to the Justice Department's application by Thursday at noon. The court could rule quickly in the following days. Saying the matter was urgent and important, the Justice Department brief also asked the court to consider adding the question of the law's constitutionality to the docket of cases it plans to hear this year, bypassing the appeals court, which is scheduled to hear arguments on it in December. The Supreme Court has already scheduled to hear another major abortion case involving a Mississippi law in December. The Justice Department said, quote, SB 8 is an affront to the United States' sovereign interests in maintaining the supremacy of federal law and ensuring that the traditional mechanisms of judicial review endorsed by Congress and this court remain available to challenge unconstitutional state laws. Rapid deployment of technology during COVID public health restrictions saw spikes in telehealth visits, the practice of providing care remotely via video and other online tools. According to new data, patients have continued to access care remotely, especially for behavioral and mental health. Eric Galatis has more with the Public News Service.
The use of telehealth services, a combination of telephone, video, and other online tools, peaked during COVID closures, and Coloradans are still opting for remote visits, according to new data. Social isolation and other disruptions saw mental and behavioral telehealth visits rise dramatically. Carrie Frank with the Center for Improving Value in Healthcare says for some, remote services greatly reduce the barrier of the stigma still associated with mental health.
Especially in a rural area where, you know, everybody can see your car parked in front of the therapist. If you're able to do that from the comfort of your own home, then that gives you a comfortable space to go and find those services and get the care that you need.
Mental health services rose from 37% of all telehealth visits in 2019 to 53% in 2020. Federal and state policymakers helped pave the way for increased access to telehealth by removing much of the red tape that restricted provider compensation, especially for Medicaid coverage. Remote visits help hospitals and insurance companies save money, but many physicians have warned against abandoning traditional hands-on in in-person visits. Frank says telehealth is probably appropriate for around 25% of healthcare services.
It's not something that's going to replace the doctor being able to listen to your breathing with a stethoscope, but I do think that we should be making sure that we're utilizing technology that we have at our fingertips.
Telehealth can include digital monitoring of blood sugar levels for people with diabetes and heart rates for people with cardiovascular issues. Frank notes that remote services can also help more people access healthcare in the middle of the workday.
Have to take off work. Not everybody can do that. So having a 10-minute call with them on a break, if you're having some issue that is acute and they can just send a prescription to Walgreens, I think it's just more convenient for a lot of people.
This is Eric Galatis reporting.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on problems with the war on terror with David Rosenberg, followed by Noise Filter, debunking myths about the COVID-19 pandemic. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, stick around for Prison Pipeline. And at 7, we'll hear Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 43 degrees. Tomorrow will again be partly cloudy with a high of 68. Today in history, in 1867, the U.S. formally takes possession of Alaska after purchasing the territory from Russia for $7.2 million, or less than 2 cents an acre. The quote of the day is from American politician and four-star general Colin Powell, who passed away Monday from COVID-19 complications. Powell was the first Black Secretary of State and a trailblazing military commander. In his book, My American Journey, Powell wrote, quote, "The healthiest competition occurs when average people win by putting in above average effort." Postal workers across the country are concerned about slowdowns and cuts to post office hours. They say the Postmaster General's 10-year plan lacked transparency and input from postal workers. Lily Bolke has more.
Post offices across the nation are implementing service changes in an effort by the agency to cut costs, but labor leaders say the move could have major repercussions for workers and customers alike. Since October 1st, service standards have been altered to slow the pace of delivery for some first-class mail while cutting retail hours and increasing prices. Roscoe Woods, with the American Postal Workers Union in Michigan, says this is the wrong approach. He says the USPS is designed as a public service, not a business.
We have this massive infrastructure with the capability of meeting our commitments and then some. And this Postmaster General has taken the position that we should continue to increase the cost to our customers while reducing service. And I think it's one of the worst ideas ever.
Woods says the plan was made without input from union members and many of those workers who have been with the agency for decades. Michigan is one of 20 states that recently filed an administrative complaint asking for a more detailed review. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy has said the Postal Service is hiring 40,000 seasonal workers to help with the holiday rush and that the changes are needed to trim $160 billion loss by 2030. Chris Shaw is a historian of the USPS and published author. He says these changes already are affecting small business owners who often depend on first-class mail. He says some may turn to other delivery providers, which could lead to further privatization of the mailing industry.
These changes are part of a trend where the Postal Service is conceived of not as a government agency, a public service that exists to serve everyone on a universal basis and in a uniform manner, and instead conceiving it more like a for-profit business.
He adds there are other ways to cut losses, for instance, venturing into areas such as banking. He says a pilot program has launched at 4 post offices to do some payroll and business check cashing and hopes these kinds of financial services could be expanded. I'm Lily Bolke reporting.
The Senate will take another stab at passing a voting rights bill. Democrats push the Build Back Better plan, and the supply chain gridlock could stick around through 2022. With more on those stories, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Defending our fundamental right to vote should not be a partisan issue.
The Senate is planning a procedural vote this week on the Freedom to Vote Act. It allows more voting by mail, creates automatic registration, expands early voting, and makes Election Day a federal holiday. California Democrat Alex Padilla says it's a successor to the For the People Act, which Republicans filibustered twice.
Our Republican colleagues' deeds don't match their words. They'll say publicly that they support voting rights, but their actions show something different.
At least 10 Republican votes are needed for the bill to advance, with just 2 weeks until a self-imposed deadline. Democrats are pulling out the stops to pass President Joe Biden's Build Back Better plan. The package was projected to cost $3.5 trillion, but has been trimmed after pushback from Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. Pramila Jayapal of Washington State is chair of the House Progressive Caucus.
In both the Senate and the House, we are united in our insistence that these priorities, climate action, the care economy, housing, roadmap to citizenship, expanded health care, and tax fairness, are included and funded in the final bill.
Wyoming Republican Senator Cynthia Lummis says spending's out of control and calls the package irresponsible.
We won't address the real problems in this country that led us to be $28 trillion plus in debt and now asking to get further in debt. I'm horrified.
A new Vox poll confirms that 2/3 of voters support the plan and 71% favor raising taxes on the top 2% to pay for it. In spite of White House efforts, supply chain disruptions could extend into next year. That was the message of Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg on the Sunday news shows. With some store shelves empty, retailers are warning there are products that may not be available for the holidays. Spencer Armstrong has worked for food company Tyson for 25 years. He says he's never seen anything like it.
What we're seeing right now over time is that reaction to everything that happened in the pandemic. So, you know, we all know why we're here. I mean, labor shortages, all the ports are backed up, can't get product off those.
Last week, the Biden administration pushed West Coast ports to operate 24/7. Hundreds of grieving families were at the U.S. Capitol Saturday for the annual Peace Officers Memorial Service. President Joe Biden paid tribute to the 500 who died in the line of duty over the last 2 years, and he specifically honored the police who defended the Capitol building during the January 6 riot.
Because of you, democracy survived.
Biden also spoke against the Defund the Police movement and promised more resources for law enforcement. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support accuracy and transparency online at publicnewsservice.org.
Hundreds are arrested during People versus Fossil Fuel demonstrations in Washington, D.C., and tribes and conservation groups call for an investigation into new Montana mining claims. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Indigenous youth led a march to the Capitol Friday as part of week-long People versus Fossil Fuels demonstrations in Washington, D.C. The week included demonstrations outside the White House, an Army Corps office, and a sit-in at the Department of the Interior. According to the Indigenous Environmental Network, an organizer, more than 600 people were arrested during demonstrations last week. Joy Braun with the Indigenous Environmental Network was among those arrested. She told Democracy Now! Their message is directed to President Biden.
We wanted to bring the front lines to his doorstep to let him see that we are very serious about climate change and declaring a climate emergency. People versus Fossil Fuels came out of Build Back Fossil Free, a coalition of over 200 frontline organizations around the United States that came together and said, we're not being heard. We're not being listened to, and we have to unite.
They're also calling on the administration and Congress to stop all new fossil fuel projects. The Fort Belknap Indian community is requesting an investigation after a mining company filed claims on an environmental reclamation area south of the reservation. Taylor Stagner with Yellowstone Public Radio has more.
The Zortman-Landusky Mine Reclamation Area has been under a mineral withdrawal for 20 years. That's an administrative process that keeps land exempt from new mining claims. The Federal Department of Interior has been renewing the mineral withdrawal every 5 years, but earlier this month, a lapse in that agreement opened up the reclamation area for 48 hours, allowing a mining company out of Minnesota to lay claims on it. Tribal community members and environmental activists want answers about the lack of communication between the Department of Interior, the tribes, and the environmental rights groups that have been working since the late 90s to clean up the Zortman-Landusky mine. Bonnie Gestring is with the conservation group Earthworks. She says the organization has been working to treat water at the old mine.
So the extension of the mineral withdrawal is really crucial because not only do we need to protect the existing reclamation work, but there's ongoing reclamation work and water treatment that needs to be protected in order to provide a safe public resource for those public lands and for the people who live downstream, which is, of course, the Fort Belknap Indian community.
Gestring says that the reclamation project has cost around $50 million of state and federal funds. The Fort Belknap Indian community and the environmental nonprofits on this project are still waiting a response from the Department of Interior. For National Native News, I'm Taylor Stagner.
New data and maps show the pandemic's impact across American Indian and Alaska Native communities. The Mountain West News Bureau's Maggie Mullen reports.
When Navajo Nation saw its first cases of COVID-19 in March 2020, Jordan Bennett Begay started a spreadsheet. She's the managing editor of Indian Country Today, and the spreadsheet was a way to track coronavirus cases across indigenous communities. At the time, that data was incomplete. Today, that spreadsheet has evolved into an interactive and comprehensive set of maps and data that are available online. The project was a collaboration between the news outlet and the Johns Hopkins Center for American Indian Health. Allison Barlow directs the center.
This is so important in terms of allocation of resources, whether it was, you know, PPE at the beginning of the pandemic or diagnostic testing, antibody testing, and so forth. How do you distribute these federal resources if you don't know really where the hotspots are?
The maps are available to the public and are updated regularly using data from tribes. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new project helps organizations access federal climate funds. The Justice 40 Accelerator provides fundraising support and training to grassroots groups. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The Biden administration has promised that 40% of all federal climate and clean energy investments will go to communities long burdened by pollution and underinvestment.
So we're talking about millions and millions of dollars that will now be appropriated to communities that have been disinvested in for a long time.
That's Nathaniel Smith, founder and chief equity officer of the Partnership for Southern Equity. He says this infusion of federal dollars could be transformative if it goes to the people and groups who need it most. He says grants are often awarded to the same usual suspects, large, well-connected organizations. Meanwhile, grassroots groups may not have grant writing experience, extra bandwidth to devote to fundraising, or connections.
So there are many, many barriers and challenges that historically organizations and businesses owned by people of color have to deal with when they're trying to get federal dollars.
So his organization has partnered on a project called the Justice 40 Accelerator. It will provide training and support to local groups applying for funds. Smith says it will help ensure that federal funds reach environmental justice organizations that are working on local solutions. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 18th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, your stories, and your tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes David Rosenberg, our producer is Yasmin Kobunoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Eric Galatis, Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, and Anthony Leisowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website, kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings.
Dr. Demento, and you are listening to the KBOO News, the only news you need.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Now that the U.S. has withdrawn its troops from Afghanistan and the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks has come and gone, some commentators are reflecting on the so-called war on terror that has been so much a part of our political landscape. Khalid Badaun is a professor at Wayne State University School of Law. KPFA weekend news anchor and KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Badaun and asked him if there's a problem with the whole concept of the war on terror.
I thought it was, you know, an absurd idea then when it was initially coined and conceived. And it's even more absurd today, you know, as a consequence of, you know, the evidence that has been compiled over those last two decades. Can you have a war on a general concept and an idea? It was never really a war on terror, though, right? Terror is broad. That encompasses so much, you know, so many forms of violence. However, in actuality, it was a war on Islam. It was a war on Muslims globally.
Although I remember George Bush Jr. sort of tried to say, we're not against the Muslim world, we're against these groups, these terrorist groups.
Yeah, it's exactly what he said. He said that we're against the Taliban, we're against Al-Qaeda back then when the war was initially commenced. But now as we reflect back on what took place over the last two decades, right, we can clearly see that the violence of the war was inflicted on far more than just those two groups and organizations, right? We have the aftermath of the war in Afghanistan, which was just ended weeks ago, which ended with